Hopefully you guys enjoy this winter weather that has begun. It actually feels like winter, doesn't it? That's a good feeling. We'll do without the fog, but at least we have some winter. How quickly this year has gone. We're looking back at 1 year ago. Man, it's just so fast. We were just here doing this. So as you guys get your seats, we will get ready to begin here. I want to start off today reading from Luke 6, 43 to 45. We're going to study our passage in Acts 25, but Luke 6, 43 is going to be an interpretive for us. As Luke records these words right after Jesus had finished preaching the Beatitudes, and then he's facing the hypocrisy of the Jewish leaders. They're already after him in his ministry, and this is what he said. No good tree bears bad fruit, nor again does a bad tree bear good fruit. For each tree is known by its own fruit. For figs are not gathered from thorn bushes, nor are grapes picked from a bramble bush. The good person out of the good treasure of his heart produces good, and the evil person out of his evil treasure produces evil. For out of the abundance of the heart the mouth speaks. So we're going to use that as an interpretive for the section we're going to be looking at in Acts 25. With that, let's open with a word of prayer. Gracious God, every single Sunday we come here, it is a joy to open your word, to look into knowing you and understanding what it is about you that we can appreciate more, we can love more, we can have our lives greater emulate who you are because of what you have written down, what you've recorded. Through your own life, through the life of other saints that have followed after you. And God, this passage this morning, I pray that we would be able to apply it and have our lives be in greater conformity to you, to worship you, especially at this Christmas season. I pray that we have opportunity to do this in front of others, for others, in your name. Amen. We've only got a few weeks left in our study of Acts. It's going fast, and we're quickly coming to the end of the history of the foundation of the church as recorded by Luke to Theophilus. Paul, our central character, has really been the main character the last half of the book. He's now imprisoned, and we've seen three of six different defenses that he has given as he has been held there. The passage we're going to explore today has no deep theological underpinnings. It doesn't reveal any profound doctrines. It's not one of those passages you whip out your Bible and you show somebody, look, you know, here's where it proves this kind of a thing to an unbeliever or to a believer. And besides, this passage, if we took this section out that happens in Caesarea, if we took this out and it was no longer in the Bible, you would know that it was gone. You would know that you cut it out because it would be a Caesarean section. I'm going to start on that. Nevertheless, this section is inspired by God, and as he moved Luke to write it, it does provide us great insights onto how we should live our daily lives. In BTI terms, we would refer to it as practical theology. It's a practical theology section for us to look into. So let's read the passage first and then take it apart. I don't see this as an academic study so much as it is really an opportunity to look into the analytic side of it. We're going to analyze really this in the latter half of our time today. So if you haven't turned there yet in your Bibles, turn to Acts 25. In fact, we're going to break this up. We're going to back up a few verses. Darren didn't really cover this as well. He kind of ended right before this. Back up with me to chapter 24, verse 27. Chapter 24, verse 27. When 2 years had elapsed, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus, and desiring to do the Jews a favor, Felix left Paul in prison. Now 3 days after Festus had arrived in the province, he went up to Jerusalem from Caesarea, and the chief priests and the principal men of the Jews laid out their case against Paul, and they urged him, asking as a favor against Paul that he summon him to Jerusalem, because they were planning on ambush to kill him on the way. Festus replied that Paul was being kept at Caesarea and that he himself intended to go there shortly. So he said, let the men of authority among you go down with me, and if there is anything wrong about the man, let them bring charges against him. After he stayed among them not more than 8 or 10 days, he went down to Caesarea. And the next day he took his seat on the tribunal and ordered Paul to be brought. When he arrived, the Jews who had come down from Jerusalem stood around him, bringing many and serious charges against him that they could not prove. Paul argued in his defense, "Neither against the law of the Jews, nor against the temple, nor against Caesar have I committed any offense." But Festus, wishing to do the Jews a favor, said to Paul, "Do you wish to go up to Jerusalem and there be tried on these charges before me?" But Paul said, "I am standing before Caesar's tribunal where I ought to be tried. To the Jews I have done no wrong, as you yourself know very well. If then I am a wrongdoer and have committed anything for which I deserve to die, I do not seek to escape death. But if there is nothing to their charges against me, no one can give me up to them. I appeal to Caesar." Then Festus, when he had conferred with him, with his council, answered, "To Caesar you have appealed, to Caesar you shall go." I'm going to break this up into five sections. It's pretty easy. As I said, it's really not analytical here, this first part. We're going to go look at the seat changing, the survey of the situation, the second plot, successful defense, and the sending to Caesar. So Paul has already given a defense before the Jews at the temple when he was beaten unjustly, very first time, right when he was arrested, he gave a defense there. He gave this really from the steps leading up to Fort Antonia. Then he gave a defense before Lysias, you might remember that, and the Sanhedrin, where their false charges couldn't be proved. He was sent up to Caesarea and gave a defense to the governor Felix. But Felix procrastinated. He didn't really give a verdict. He sat for a long time. He wouldn't make a ruling. He was hoping for a bribe, we learned last week. Hey, I'll take some money and then you can get out of here. But he found that it was easier to use Paul really as a pawn for the Jews, as, you know, hey, this I'm still doing this as a favor to the Jewish leaders. But we learned last week that from Darren that Felix really didn't have a handle on the Jews, and he made some major blunders in his overseeing of them as governor. It always had him on edge. He didn't want the word of unrest among the Jews to get out and get back to Rome. He had recently brutally suppressed a riot in Caesarea, and this had so infuriated the Jews. They were so upset at this that they had written to Rome to get him removed from office. Nero recalled him to Rome to answer serious charges, but his stepbrother Paulus intervened, and we don't hear from him much after that in history. He's just kind of devoid of there. So he's out of the scene now. We see our first step of our narrative. We see the seat changing. Verse 27 of chapter 24. When 2 years had elapsed, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus, and desiring to do the Jews a favor, Felix left Paul in prison. It's been 2 years now. Paul has been left in prison in Caesarea. It was common for governors to clean up matters before they left. They know that their time is over. They've been told that, hey, I got somebody else coming in to take your position. So it's normal for them to tie up all the loose ends at the end of their post there. And there hadn't been any charges against Paul, so it would have been logical to release him at that time. He knew he wasn't going to get a bribe from Paul or the disciples. I could almost think this term that it talks in here, to do the Jews a favor, may have been a monetary favor. Maybe they were paying him to keep it. I couldn't find anything to prove that, any evidence of it, but it kind of made sense the way they've been doing everything else that they wanted to. The Jews probably wanted Paul on the street, though, more than they wanted him in prison, because then they'd have a chance to get him if they could catch him somewhere. They didn't want him protected by the Romans. I wonder what happened to those Jews in chapter 23, verse 12. There were some Jews that made an oath 2 years back. It says, "When it was day, the Jews made a plot and bound themselves by an oath neither to eat nor drink till they had killed Paul." There were more than 40 who made this conspiracy. They went to the chief priests and elders and said, "We have strictly bound ourselves by an oath to taste no food till we have killed Paul." I wonder what they did for the last 2 years. For some reason, I don't think they kept their oath. But obviously, Paul was still on their mind, wasn't he? They were still remembering, hey, this guy has been a problem. Let's deal with this guy still. We don't know much about Porcius Festus. He was not a former slave like Felix was. Rather, he was a member of the Roman nobility. He was a pretty high-level guy, married to somebody else who was high-level. He only has a brief 2-year term in office before he dies. Josephus described him as a better than his predecessor or his successor. So he was, in the eyes of the Jews, he was a decent ruler for them during the time he was there. He appears to have kept peace in Palestine during this time. So he kind of kept some peace. That was his job to do that. So the seat is changed. Next, we see a survey of the situation. Festus arrives in Palestine, and he gets right to work. Look at verse 1 of chapter 25. Now, 3 days after Festus had arrived in the province, he went up to Jerusalem from Caesarea. He knew ahead of time that his work was cut out for him. This was not an easy situation to deal with all these different aspects of religion and everything else in there. His job was to keep the peace in the area and to collect as much taxes as he could from him. He inherited a tough situation from Felix, though, and it would demand balance. He wasn't a procrastinator like his predecessor, was he? I mean, he's going to get right to this right away. So 3 days after getting into Judea, he goes up to Jerusalem, right to where the Sanhedrin is. He knows that's where their center of power is. He knows that the high priest and the Sanhedrin are really the key to maintaining peace. So he's going to go right at it. I'm just going to go right into this situation. The Jewish leaders had successfully blackmailed their governor into executing Christ unjustly. They had done the same thing with, they're going to try to do the same thing. They've been trying to do the same thing with Paul as well. In any new situation, strong leaders that are wise, they immediately go and show their power. They're going to assert themselves as quickly as they can to assert the ground rules. Hey, this is how we're going to engage each other. So they're going to have a headbutting here, what's going on, what their expectations are going forward. Take as much as ground as you can and never give it up is really the theory behind a lot of this. So Festus surveyed the situation, and the chess game begins now. Verse 2, the Jewish leaders move right into action, and this is going to be the third issue, is the second plot. And the chief priests and the principal men of the Jews laid out their case against Paul, and they urged him, asking as a favor against Paul that he summon him to Jerusalem, because they were planning an ambush to kill him on the way. Festus replied that Paul was being kept at Caesarea and that he himself intended to go there shortly. So, said he, let the men of authority come among you to go down with me, and if there is anything wrong about the men, let them come and bring charges against him. After he stayed among them, not more than 8 or 10 days, he went down to Caesarea. Last plot that we saw, chapter 23, verse 12, it involved an ambush just about 2 years earlier where the Sanhedrin was an accomplice to what was going on. This time, they're at the center of it. I mean, it's them. It's the Jewish leaders. They say, we are the ones that are going to be doing this. You can almost see them in a huddle. Okay, guys, here's our chance. It's our play. We got the ball now. What are we going to do? What play do we want to use? Are we going to go down the middle? Are we going to throw a long bomb? Oh, hey, let's use that play that we used before, the ambush play, Operation Ambush into play. And it's almost like they're winking their eye. Hey, set the plan in motion. We know what we want to do. This is our plan, our chance to get this guy. We've been working on this for years. You know, we've been brewing this thing up. They are ready to go. But this didn't work with Festus. He already knew about Paul. He answered them, Paul was being kept at Caesarea. Immediately he knew Paul. Paul is being kept at Caesarea. He knew that already was occurring. He was likely one of the most notorious prisoners at the time in the jail. And so there was word, hey, this is a big thing that you need to know about. And likely Festus was smart enough to ask ahead of time, hey, what are the key issues as I go into this new province, this new territory? What are the key issues that I need to know about? And Paul was one of them. He also knew that the judgment seat for trials was in Caesarea, and it would be the proper place to hold a trial. It's not in Jerusalem. It would be there where Paul is held. To show them his goodwill, he granted their request to have a speedy trial, but it's going to be under his terms, under his conditions. Sure, I'll deal with Paul for you, but you're going to have to come to my place of authority. You can see this power thing where I'm making sure you guys know who's in power here. He also wanted to let them know that he wanted to honor their authority structure. They had a structure, and he was going to honor that as he identified them as the men of authority among you. So he said, hey, there's guys that are in authority here. I recognize you. You have power. I'm going to work with you guys. Let's come have a meeting. But most of all, we see God's divine hand of sovereign providence in this, don't we? That's where Paul was, and that he knew ahead of time and set this up. Even the fact that he knew he was going to be going there in a couple days. There was no reason to send for Paul and have him come up to Jerusalem up because it was higher in elevation. Instead, it was, no, I'm going there in a few days. You come to me under my turf there. He's already planning to return to Caesarea. So Festus hangs out a few more days in Jerusalem. This gives the Jews time to prepare their court proceedings that they're going to have against him, make their case. Festus is getting a further understanding of the land, the customs, the people, who the players are, the power structures, their strengths, their weaknesses. That's exactly what these guys would do. They want to know what's going on here. And then he goes back to Caesarea. I've driven the distance. It's about an hour and a half drive, about 75 miles. It would have taken a day or two in their time. It's not that far. It's a coastal city of Caesarea. So we saw the sea-changing survey of the situation, the second plot. Now let's look at the successful defense, the middle of verse 6. Successful defense. And the next day, he took his seat on the tribunal and ordered Paul to be brought. When he had arrived, the Jews who had come down from Jerusalem stood around him, bringing many and serious charges against him that they could not prove. Paul argued in his defense, "Neither against the law of the Jews, nor against the temple, nor against Caesar have I committed any offense." But Festus, wishing to do the Jews a favor, said to Paul, "Do you wish to go up to Jerusalem and there be tried on these charges before me?" But Paul said, "I am standing before Caesar's tribunal where I ought to be tried. To the Jews I have done no wrong, as you yourself know very well. If then am I a wrongdoer, if committed anything which I deserve to die, I do not seek to escape death." Festus goes right into action here. He took his seat on the tribunal. The word seat is bima. Later on, Paul uses this word a couple different times, 2 Corinthians 5:10, stating that the church-age saints are going to appear before the bima seat, or the bima seat judgment, for which we're all going to appear at the judgment seat of Christ, it says. The purpose of bima is an exhaustive evaluation. So it's everything of our lives. That's what the bema seat judgment is. 1 Corinthians 4:5 says, "The Lord will come and bring to light the hidden things of darkness and reveal the counsels of the heart. Then each one's praise will come from God." So that's the word that he's using here. Festus did not do an exhaustive evaluation of Paul. But this seat for him was the specifically identified location for him to rule from for an official Roman trial. Luke uses very technical terms here. This is very legalistic. So it's really proceeding as a real trial, not just a kangaroo court for them. So the Jewish leaders, their brightest attorneys, their smartest guys, they come down from Jerusalem, and they stood all around him to make serious charges against Paul. But they couldn't prove him. It's been 2 years, and they still can't produce a single witness, not a person of all that group that was there that can say, "Yes, Paul did this, and Paul did that." They found false witnesses for Christ, remember that? And they paid them off. They found false witnesses for Stephen back a while back, but here they didn't produce anyone. They have nothing to stand on. Paul didn't give an extra lengthy defense here. It was a rather simple defense. He kept it simple and to the point. He was innocent, and his life was one that obeyed the law. That's a great example for us, isn't it? He just always obeyed the law. He identified three arenas of innocence. First, there was an accusation of sectarianism against the law of the Jews. There was nothing they could charge him that was worthy of death by Jewish laws. Jewish laws had certain things that you would die if you did certain things, or you would be killed if you did them. There was nothing among that that they could prove. That was very clear. He cleared that up. We learned a few weeks ago that the Romans allowed the Jews to punish even to death for certain egregious offenses. Secondly, the accusation of sacrilege against the temple. That was another thing that for the Jews was very important, and they had worked with the Romans to establish you are allowed to punish unto death. Remember, we talked about the fact if somebody went into an area and they were a Gentile, they were worthy of death. There was nothing like that here again. He was innocent. The third accusation of sedition against Caesar, or against Caesar, it says in there. There's nothing that they could prove that he did anything that would have been against Caesar for any reason that would have caused any penalty, let alone one for death. There was nothing there. It's an airtight defense that he put up, and it really put Festus in a situation similar to what Felix was facing. You know, Felix had this exact same thing. Hey, this guy's being accused by them, and now he has to deal with it. If he lets Paul go, Festus, within 2 weeks of taking office, is going to start a riot there. But that's bad news. That will get back to Rome. And what in the world are you doing? Well, we sent you there to make peace and to clear this thing up. And now you caused a riot within 2 weeks of getting there? That's not going to look good. Your career path is not going to be very well if this happens to you. So he's trying to think through this thing. Festus didn't procrastinate here. He didn't sweep it under the rug like Felix did. So he offers a compromise. He says, I got a compromise here. He wants to give the Jewish leaders another run at it. Hey, let's let the Jewish leaders try him down in Jerusalem. I'll take him there. Maybe he's also going to give him some of his lawyers. Hey, you guys did a lousy job in your defense here. I'll give you some guys and we'll come up with something. We can make this thing work. For the Jews, that's all they wanted. They wanted to change the venue because Paul being transported was the key to their defense, because it wasn't going to be a defense. It was a chance for elimination. They wouldn't even have to prepare a case if it was being held down in Jerusalem, because they were going to take care of him before he got there. No case if no Paul. Festus tried to placate Paul by showing that he himself was going to be ruling over the proceedings. Hey, I'll be watching over this thing. I'll be in charge of this whole thing here. And the Jews didn't care who presided. Hey, that's fine. You can preside over it, because it wasn't going to happen. Paul's not going to be there. We've got it made. And Paul saw right through it. He says, I know what they're after here. Roman justice was being undermined by political expediency. This was all a political move that he was making. Tannenhill, in his commentary, states that Festus's response was that of a political novice not yet aware of who holds power and what their interests are, who quickly learns about the high priests, their importance to Rome, and the strength of their convictions that Paul should be tried in Jerusalem. He just fell right into that with that one. Paul doesn't expect Festus to delve into the theological issues that he shared, because it was a theological issue to them. But rather, his job is to maintain justice. As the Roman governor, that's what he is supposed to do, maintain justice with respect to what is presented. The Jews are the ones accusing Paul of this whole thing. There's no way that it should be held in their court. It doesn't make sense. They cannot act as part of the judging. So masterfully, Paul replies in verse 10. He says, I am standing before Caesar's tribunal, where I ought to be tried. To the Jews I have done no wrong, as you yourself very well know. This both reminded Caesar of who his boss was. Ultimately, it was God, but his boss back in Rome, that's who he's accountable to. And hey, if you make a bad judgment here, you're accountable to this. Not to the Jews, but to Caesar. He's standing precisely in the place where he needed to be tried. This is exactly the right venue for him. There's no reason to try him in Jerusalem. Paul sums up the plaintiff's argument and Festus' interpretation of the facts real easy. To the Jews, I have done no wrong, as you yourself very well know. He says, you know in your conscience that I am innocent here. He calls Festus to integrity is what he's doing. Roman law demanded that innocent people be released, especially Romans that are being accused by non-Romans. I mean, that's what the case is here. Festus had no option here. He's in trouble on this one. But Paul went even further. Verse 11. If then I am a wrongdoer and have committed anything for which I deserve to die, I do not seek to escape death. But if there is nothing to their charges against me, no one can give me up to them. I appeal to Caesar. He is willing to take responsibility for his actions, as we should. If we do something against the law, we should be responsible for those actions. He's not evading justice, but he's just demanding it here. He's innocent. Festus knows he's innocent. His accusers know he's innocent. He sees no reason to have his life turned over to these Jewish leaders. There's a wisdom in this. As a side note, it's likely that Paul knew some of these guys who were the accusers. Remember, he was part of the Sanhedrin. He was there with them. They gave him his orders to go and kill the Jews 20-some years before this thing. He knew what they were capable of because he was one of them. Paul knew that a trial in Jerusalem would mean that his death, but also he remembered what happened 2 years back when he was in prison. I mean, there's so much that's happened here that's brought him to this point. Acts 23:11. Let me read this. The following night, this is 2 years back, the following night the Lord stood by him and said, take courage, for as you have testified to the facts about me in Jerusalem, so you must testify also in Rome. Hey, I know that I'm not going to end up getting killed in Jerusalem. He just has this in the back of his brain the whole time. See how God works through his sovereignty in everything. And it's his will. Through the actions of man, Paul gave wisdom to speak to Festus exactly the words to carry out God's plan. So Paul's last words that he says here, it should have been, I demand that you set me free right now because I am innocent. Instead, what did he say? He said, I appeal to Caesar. Right then and there, the trial stopped. That's it. Done. Complete. Trial's over. They can now shut the whole thing down. That ended it. Festus had his solution. Hey, I can get out of this one. Paul's legal request immediately took it out of his hands. As a Roman citizen, this appeal allowed the venue now to be moved to Caesar. Send him to Rome. Really made sense to him. He didn't have to face the Jews of having let him go. It made him look good both in Rome and in Judea, because a riot didn't break out, and the Jews are still, now at least he's in prison and they get rid of him. But Paul was the one who requested the opportunity. That was perfect. Man, that was just ideal. What a great escape this thing was. Little conference he had with his council in verse 12 was likely spent identifying exactly how this would be reported, because if this just was, hey, just send this guy because we don't want to deal with him, that's not going to work. Paul was received in Rome, and there's no evidence, no case, nothing against him, they had to come up with at least something to say, this is what we need to charge this guy with so that they would deal with it. They didn't want to appear to have poorly handled a case down here in Judea. So we've seen the seat-changing survey of the situation, the second plot, successful defense, and now sending to Caesar. Verse 12, then Festus, when he had conferred with his council, answered, to Caesar you have appealed, to Caesar you shall go. You realize this is insanity on Paul's part? You realize what he's just done? You know who Caesar was at this time? You know who it was? It was Nero. Yes. He hadn't gone into his full rage yet, Nero hadn't, against Christians, but Nero had already shown himself to be a maniac. This guy's nuts. Nero will prove to be one of the absolute most evil, vile, brutal rulers on the planet, especially towards Christians. A brief study of his life shows him murdering people. This is just fascinating. I looked into this. His stepbrother Britannicus murdered him at an early age. His mother Agrippina murdered her. Lovers of girls that he wanted to marry murdered them. His wife Octavia, yep, took care of her. His wife Poppaea, who he kicked to death before she gave birth to their second child. Various other leaders of the Senate, rivals, including Paulus, who was Felix's brother-in-law. So he just, anybody gets in his way. It was said by one historian of his time, he killed whomever he pleased. This guy just, he was an outrage, and it was pandemonium. It was like there was no control of this guy everywhere. He was known to be an extremely immoral man, you know, visiting brothels, just doing anything he wanted to whatever debauchery level he wanted. We also knew he would throw Christians to the dogs, to the lions. He crucified and burned them. Then he blamed the fire of Rome on them. Eventually, it was Nero who sent troops down to Jerusalem and knocked the walls down and actually tore the temple down. Those were troops that he had sent in 70 AD. He eventually forced, this is where his life went to, he forced one of his few remaining subjects at the end of his life to dig a grave for him and then to kill him because he couldn't kill himself. He tried to, but he couldn't. He was even asking these guys, kill yourself to show me how to kill myself right in front of him at the last minute as troops are coming. Just a coward. While his enemies are coming after him, finally he had one of his guys kill him. This is to whom Paul is appealing. Brilliant move, Paul. Because of the injustice he was getting in Judea? Why do you think he'd do this? What is it you think would do this? Tell me. Give me some ideas. His trust in God? I love it. Yeah. His desire to fill the call. His desire to go to Rome. Yeah. Yeah. Those are the two of the thoughts that come into my mind. First, what a testimony to the Gentiles. What a testimony as they saw this. The Gentile believers, especially for them to understand that Christianity was not just a Jewish issue. I mean, this thing, the courts are going to be trying him. He's being tried on all these things. It wasn't just a thing that was handled in Judea. They're soon going to be facing persecutions of their own, all the rest of these Gentile Christians and Jewish Christians all over the world. Who better to show them how to handle it? Man, you're going straight to this guy, and you're going to let him have control over your life? How do you handle oppressive government? Oh, Paul just showed you how. So these are great things that he did as an example to the Gentiles. Secondly, I see it as Paul's opportunity to share the gospel with even a greater audience. I mean, he saw that. That's what he was after. He wanted to reach more. The leaders of the world, he has a chance to share before them. He's gotten governors and other people. Now it's the leaders of the whole world. This would be an unprecedented opportunity for him to spread the truth of Christ. And didn't the Lord appear to himself and tell him that he would have this opportunity? You must bear witness of me in Rome. So he knows it, man, I've got to go. This is where I'm going. I think Paul is actually quite excited at the opportunity. I think he's like, yes, it worked. I get to go to Rome. You know, Nero, brilliant. But he's figuring this thing out. Think of it as being in Europe in 1944 and being tried as a dissenter, appealing to Hitler to be your judge and being a Jew. Not smart. That's bold. Festus granted Paul's appeal, and the Lord kept his promise. Paul will head to Rome. Pretty cool the way this worked out. Now, I want to go back and analyze this passage, as I promised at the very beginning, in light of Luke 6, 43 to 45. Let me read that again. For no good tree bears bad fruit, nor again does a bad tree bear good fruit. For each tree is known by its own fruit. For figs are not gathered from thorn bushes, nor are grapes picked from a bramble bush. But the good person out of the good treasure of his heart produces good, and the evil person out of his evil treasure produces evil. For out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. This passage was just on my brain for the last couple weeks. Parenting class with Gabe's this week, we were talking about it. This drives a lot. It's the foundation of the parenting classes that we've been teaching, because you have to analyze what it is in the heart. It's out of the abundance of the heart is what produces what we say and what we do. That's always flowing out of our heart. Whatever in our heart is going to come out. It's going to be there. We can interpret our heart in light of what we say and do, because our actions reveal our heart. And that's exactly what we're going to look at this passage here. Parallel passage to Luke 6 is Mark 7, but it has a bit more explanation. So let me read this one as well. In this one, Mark takes the overflow of the heart and he gives definition to it. It gives us an interpretive categories to look at actions based upon what is in the heart. Starting in verse 14 of Mark 7. And he called the people to him again and said to them, "Hear me, all of you, and understand. There is nothing outside a person that by going into him can defile him. But the things that come out of a person are what defile him. And when he had entered the house and left the people, his disciples asked him about the parable. And he said to them, Then are you also without understanding? Do you not see that whatever goes into a person from outside cannot defile him, since it enters not his heart but his stomach and is expelled? Thus he declared all foods clean. And he said, what comes out of a person is what defiles him. For from within, out of the heart of man, now listen carefully, comes evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, coveting, wickedness, deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, foolishness. All these things come from within and they defile a person. That's the categories of the heart. These are things that an evil person has in their heart. We can interpret a person's, what's inside the person, by looking at their heart, by looking at their actions. Their actions will say what's in their heart. Let's go through this exercise with the characters of our passage this morning. It's kind of cool to do this. Our first character is Felix. Felix is on his way out. The former governor of Judea, what do we interpret out of his heart based upon what he said and did? For those of you who have been in the class, what were some things that were in his heart? You can cheat and look in Acts 24. Greed, okay? Yeah, because he was asking for money from Paul. Pride, okay? These are issues that are in his heart. There's foolishness in there. Weak, fear of man. Yeah, we can see all those things. He was an adulterer as well. Doesn't say that in there, but he was. Those are the things we see that were evidences of what's in his heart. Next, we have Porcius Festus. He's the new guy on the block. What can we say about what he has said and what he did that revealed his heart? What's coming out of his mouth and coming out of his actions that reveal his heart? Deceit, malice. Foolishness, yeah, that's in there. And there's also a fear of man in there. So he's afraid of these Jews. He wants to set himself right, and this is pride we've talked about. So he's kind of, I want to make sure that I'm on top of this whole situation. That's coming out of his heart. We know what's in it. Okay, here's an easy one. How about the Sanhedrin? Just any word you put in your brain that's evil, huh? What's that? Deceit. Hate. Jealousy. All the above. Yeah. Yeah, don't we see a lot going on in there? The Sanhedrin, they were Their hearts were evil, and it was showing. Now, who were these men?
They were peers of Paul.
Peers of Paul? What's their position? They're the priests. They're the leaders of the church. These are the guys that the whole community is looking up to. These are their leaders. Here are your guys to be like. And what is in their heart? What are they saying? What are they doing? Man, this is just rotten to the core. This is just bad news, what's going on here. And these guys, just about every single one of those issues in Mark 7, you're going to see in them. You know, you see evil thoughts, theft, murder, coveting, wickedness, deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, foolishness. You realize the percentage of the Ten Commandments they broke? And that's what they were holding up? Man, this is bad news. And these are the guys that are saying, yes, this guy's evil because he took somebody into the temple, which he didn't do. How about Paul? What are the actions of his heart? Obedience, fruit of the Spirit. All of them. We see him acting exactly as Christ would act. We see a heart that is saying, yes, I have Christ in me. I have something different. I am not going to play this game. I'm not going to be evil slandering these people. I'm not going to be dealing with these issues the way that they were. That's what we're watching. So here's your difference. Now we can really see. This is what Scripture tells us to do, is interpret the actions by the heart. Now you know what the heart is doing, and that's where we're deceitfully evil. As part of the parenting class, is what we teach our own children, to look at what the actions are of the kids, and then you'll see what the heart is like. And we as parents have to do the same thing as we're the parents, to look, what are our actions? Rather than, you terrible kid, look what you just did. You just lied to your brother. How dare you? How could you do that? No. You know what? I'm a liar. I cheat. I put myself first. I have pride. So now, instead of doing that to my kid, it's, you know what, son? I have a problem with lying too sometimes. You know what? There's only one way. My heart is evil. What is in my heart, what comes out of my heart, the overflow of my heart is my evil actions, just like yours were when you were lying, when you were cheating, when you were doing things that were wrong. My heart's evil too. And you know what? I can try to change my behavior here. I can all of a sudden try to be good because I got some action I want to do instead. But it's not going to help me if I don't go first and change what? What's up here? What does it come out of? The heart. It all has to be an overflow of the heart change. But can we change our hearts? No, we can't. And who changes our hearts? Bingo. So now we have the gospel brought into the whole thing. It's only Christ that can change our hearts. That's where we go to, is the cross. Now we have hope in the cross that through Christ our actions can change because our heart changes. We have different heart desires, and now we have a different result out of it. Our heart now overflows like Paul because he has a right heart following after Christ, that it's going to be actions of kindness and love and response to people in a way that you wouldn't have had through anybody else. We can't change somebody else's heart, but we can change our own hearts, right? That's where we need to work on. This is exactly why we sympathize with our kids. This is why we sympathize with other sinners. We've got it all together, and look at me, I'm goody two-shoes, I have it right. The world wants to think of us that way. That's what they ascribe to Christians. But no, I don't have it together. My heart is evil, and I would naturally sin if I didn't have from Christ. This world is doomed. This is the only opportunity I have. It's only Christ that can change our heart. It's only through the cross. It's only through his work that we have a chance of a hope of a new heart. You see how terminal it is to have a hardened heart? What happens then? It's overflowing. It ain't changing. It's just going to stay that way. A heart that is turned from God with no consideration of his atoning work, that's where we can give this hope to the rest of the world around us that's watching this spiral. At Christmas time, what a great time to share with others. You know, hey, it's this whole thing with Christ, it's about him changing our hearts because our hearts are evil. My heart is evil. And you know what? I can help you. I had a chance just this week to talk to our landlord that owns this building. And I went through this exact same thing saying, you know, it's only your heart that can change. That's the only hope that we have. It can't be just changing the behavior of this world, because he was saying how this world is spiraling and it's getting worse and worse. And how are we going to help these kids that are 2-3 years old and their parents don't care about them? We have to just train these kids for 18 to 20 years to turn them into good kids. What are you going to train them with? You don't have any morals. He says, no. I said, that's not the way it works. You have to start with their heart. And the only way to change a kid's heart, the only way to change my heart, is through the cross. And I got to just share the gospel with him, because that's our hope. That's where we can go to. We can only turn to the cross. So this season, as you spend your time with your family during the Christmas season, try to think this out. Think about, here was Paul in a situation, as simple as it is, and what did he do? He relied upon what God had done for him. He knew that God had a plan, and he pursued Christ. He was faithful to him, and God was faithful to him. And we're going to see that in the next couple weeks to come. With that, let's close in a word of prayer. God, thank you for your goodness to us, that even through a passage like this, we can introspect into ourselves and realize that our hearts are evil. We naturally turn towards sin. We have a sin nature. And it is only through you, only through the cross, that we have hope, that with Paul we could turn to appeal to somebody like Nero as being a judge of our lives, because we knew you have a plan that is far greater than we have. May we see the small trials of our lives, the difficulties, whether it be in sickness, whether it be in financial issues, whether it be in relational issues, that we would say, no, this is small compared to what you've been through, what you've done for us, and even what Paul went through. We are but a speck of dust here, and this is insignificant. How dare we think that our trials are difficult? May we see that hope in you. May you be our changer of our hearts, that we know that whatever it is that's in our heart, even as we look forward to celebrating communion later on this morning, may you be examining our hearts with us. May we see that we are pure of heart and that we want to do this to give glory to your name, to bring others to your kingdom, that you might get more glory. And we thank you for the time this morning. In your name, amen. With that, we'll see you guys back in a half hour.